This episode is sponsored by Martin Care. Welcome back to another episode of the Jewish Moves podcast. This episode is with Rabbi Beryl Wein. He's a lecturer, author, and Rav who's internationally recognized as an expert in Jewish history. He has put out over 1,000 audio tapes as well as many books and movies. Rabbi Wein, welcome to the show. How are you?
Fine, thank you.
Thank you for letting us do this. I think it makes most sense to discuss your many achievements in chronological order. So as a young boy in Chicago who is the son and grandson of local Rabbanim, did you grow up with a desire and or pressure to be a Rav?
I always wanted to be a Rav, but that was not how I started out. It was a time when, especially in Chicago, the Orthodox rabbinate didn't have a future. And most of the neighborhood changed. The Orthodox synagogues became conservative or traditional. That really was very, seemed to have very little future. So I went to law school and I became a lawyer instead. But after a period of time, the situation changed for me. I had an opportunity to become a rabbi in Miami Beach, and my wife and I decided that I should do what I want to do rather than what I had to do. So I left the law and I became a rabbi.
Very interesting. And I think you spent 9 years as a lawyer before you became a rabbi. Was that something you enjoyed? And was that something that had lessons you were able to apply to your job in the rabbinate?
Well, it certainly had lessons. You got to know people, you got to know situations. A lawyer does not necessarily know people when they are at their best. Usually gets to know them when they are in trouble or wanting to take advantage of situations, etc. I was not happy. I was not at all happy. To a certain extent, you have to have what was a different time also. A lawyer then was a general practitioner. You didn't go to a large firm. You did anything that came in the door. There wasn't that much specialization. So I was not really very happy, not at all. And especially I had clients that were observant Jews who didn't always inspire me, let's put it that way.
Uh-huh. And what brought you down to Florida and gave you the opportunity to be the Rav?
Well, I had a very good friend, Rabbi Aryeh Rotman, Zichrono Livracha, who was then the Rav in Miami Beach in a very small congregation. And we were both students of Rabbi Kreisworth, Zichrono Livracha. And he was moving from Miami Beach to Long Beach, New York. And he and Rabbi Kreisworth encouraged me to take his position in Miami Beach. And I thought it was very unlikely. But Rabbi Rotman was very persistent. And eventually I agreed that at least I would consider it. I would go for a tryout. And when I did, I liked Miami Beach, and I liked the small synagogue. I liked the people. And we left Chicago, my wife and I. We had four small children, and we moved to Miami Beach, and that was really a great turning point in my life.
Very interesting. And I read that while you were there, you said that when you first got there, you had been voted in to become the Rav by a narrow margin in the board, but you felt that when you left, you'd get a unanimous or almost unanimous decision. How did you balance keeping the community happy and, I guess, winning over their respect and admiration while simultaneously making sure you do your job to the best of your ability and the way you thought it should be done?
Well, that's always the challenge. The Gemara says that a Rav that everybody loves him and says he's great is really not doing his job. But if you don't command the respect and the cooperation of the people in the synagogue, then you're useless. So you have to, that's part of the struggle, right? I think that one thing that helped me greatly was that after my years of being a lawyer, I was able to judge individuals fairly.
Uh-huh.
And I never expected that people would agree with every word that I said. And I ever felt that I had the authority over people to make them agree. So I knew that there were people in the synagogue that had different ideas than I did. I didn't let that affect me. I really think the most difficult thing in life is not to take things personally.
Well,
which all of us do. But that really unravels the sweater if we do so. And I had learned a little of that from my parents. My father was a great Rav. My mother. And I've tried to avoid taking things personally. I also realized that you're in a strange position. You're in a position where on one hand, you're supposed to represent the Torah and Judaism, so to speak. And on the other hand, you're a human being with all the problems that come with being a human being. And that you can't look at yourself as being, so to speak, on top of a mountain, the prophet for the world. So it's a balance. And I can't say I got it right 100% of the time. But it also depends how you feel about yourself. I got up every morning and I wanted to do what I was doing. And I had a lot of self-confidence. I think that in that respect, being a lawyer helped me because in the back of my mind, I always felt that if the community didn't want me anymore, so then I could always be a lawyer. I didn't have to, I wasn't going to be completely bereft of any way of living.
Mm-hmm. And I heard that, I've heard you talk in the past about your connection to many of the Gedolim from the previous generation, like Rav Moshe Feinstein or Yaakov Kamenetsky, and they even drove around the Ponovitch Rav. I assume that you get asked this question very often, but can you share a story or memory about one of them?
Well, the Ponovizhia Rov are like Yosef Shlomo Kahaneman. All of these people were driven people. What do I mean by driven? What all of them had in common is they wanted to rebuild the Jewish world after the fact that it was almost destroyed completely in the Second World War. So each in their own way had their own unique opportunities, but it was like a common goal. And that's what drove them, and that whatever they did, they saw themselves in that light, that they were rebuilding the Jewish people. And that pushed them. And the Ponovizhia Rov told me a number of times, he was a remarkable person. And he had a mind of genius. So he told me many times, he said, I could stay home and say, give lectures in Talmud, in Shiurim. I could write magnificent commentaries in the Talmud, etc. And instead, I'm running around the world asking people for money to build these institutions. But he said, you should know that the time and the situation requires that of me, and you should have to do what is necessary to save the Jewish people, and not necessarily what you want to do. And therefore, he said, that's what I do. And he was an enormously kind, gentle, clever person. He had a wicked sense of humor. He was he had many, many encounters. And he represented... He represented to the secular Jewish world, to the Zionists, he represented a positive face of the yeshivas and of the Haredim and of observance. And he loved Jews. That's really what it was. He would begin every speech that he made. He didn't say, ladies and gentlemen, or... my dear friends, he said, brothers and sisters, and he meant that. And it was palpable. You felt his love. And so, and then you had Rabbi Feinstein, who carried on his great shoulders the burden of the Jewish people, the questions that were asked. The positions that he took, his sensitivity to others, how he dealt with people.
Wow.
And Yaakov Kamenetsky was, if there ever was a clever person, that was him. And also kind, gracious. Rabbi Yaakov lived the last 25 years of his life in Muncie. I was in Muncie then as a Rav. And he lived in the heavily Jewish Haredi section of Muncie. It's down the hill, they called it. And in that section, there was a Catholic convent of nuns who the convent had been there 100 years and before the Jews came. And let's say there was not much of a relationship between the convent and the people in the neighborhood. And when Bianco passed away, one of the nuns came and said to the family how sorry they were. They said he was the only person that always said good morning to us.
Wow. It's very impressive stories and inspirational as well. I'm curious why you chose to leave successful communities in New York and Miami to teach history.
I didn't leave them. Early on, I saw that knowing and understanding something about Jewish history was the key to greater faith and to a better understanding of the Jewish world. And I think history is fascinating. It's a story of people. People like to know stories about people. And not everybody is inspired by just laws or technical, as important as it is to know these things. But almost everybody can have a relationship to who am I? Where did I get here? What happened before me? What impels me? And that's really what history was about, and especially Jewish history. Also, Jewish history is very comforting, even though it is very brutal. And the comforting part is that whatever happens, it's happened before.
Uh-huh.
And once you realize that it's happened before, so then the situation is perilous and difficult as it may be, somehow can be assessed much more broadly, and answers found. And if you say, wow, this is all new, it never happened before, what are we going to do? You know, I was just doing a little study regarding Halacha and Corona. And you read in Halacha how there were great cholera epidemics. Earlier, the Jewish world was faced with all sorts of plagues, the bubonic plague, etc. So I don't know if that's a comfort, but at least you know that we've been there before. Part of the problem in our time is that really people feel that everything is new, that nobody has ever faced the challenges that we face. And if you believe that, so then it's very hard to deal with. But if you believe that it's happened many times before, and that somehow not only did we survive, but we're able to arrive at certain solutions and programs that help alleviate problems, so then you have a more optimistic and a more balanced view of what to do now.
Wow. And so you just mentioned our community and thoughts people in the community have. I'm curious, as someone who's studied so much Jewish history, when you compare the Jewish nation of today to the one from Europe, what is one way that you think we're better, where I've taken a step forwards, and what is one way that they're better and we should look to improve?
It's hard to define what better means. It's different. Door v'dor show of every generation has its own challenges and has its own heroes and has its own responses. And one way, for instance, the study of Torah is probably, and the study of Torah in a a manner that has depth to it is probably much greater now than it was in the previous generation. You didn't have in Europe 10s of thousands of people in yeshivot. That didn't exist. But on the other hand, you had a very broad consensus in the Jewish world as to what it was that Judaism is and what it means to be Jewish. So even if you were not totally observant, let us say, but you were totally Jewish. I don't know how to express it better than that. There's being Jewish and being observant. In our world today, there are lots of Jews who are really not Jewish. I'm not just talking halachically non-Jewish. They don't think as a Jew. They don't feel as a Jew. They're not emotionally attached to the Jewish people. They don't really have a relationship to Torah and to Hashem. And so therefore you have enormous amount of assimilation and intermarriage and all the other good things that afflict us. And you have millions of souls that one way or another are lost to us, which is something that didn't happen. In Eastern Europe, even if you were not observant, again, you certainly were Jewish. That's why secular Zionism could exist and be triumphant. Because the people felt Jewish. They felt the land of Israel Jewish. Had that relationship, but today, unfortunately, it's missing in a great, great section of the Jewish world.
Interesting. And we had spoken already about your successful career in America and everything you did there, but now you live in Israel. So I'm curious, why did you make Aliyah?
I always wanted to. I felt that I had the opportunity to live in the land of Israel, something that my ancestors would have walked across Europe in the snow barefoot to be able to accomplish. And the opportunities presented themselves, right? I was at an age already, and I had some financial stability. And the Lord helped me in many, many ways so that I had a very soft landing here. And I never thought I'd be a rabbi in Jerusalem. And you know, if you just think about it, boggles your mind. But it's almost 30 years, and it's a... great experience every day.
Wow. And I guess we'll wrap up. But before the final question, I was curious if I could ask you a few quick answer questions. What's the favorite book you put out, your favorite book?
That I wrote?
Yeah.
I think Tending the Vineyard, which is a book as to how to be a rabbi.
And what's your favorite book from somebody else?
It's hard to say that I have a favorite book. I've read so many books and so many have made an impression upon me. I'm a Civil War buff, American Civil War. I always enjoyed reading Carl Sandburg's book on Abraham Lincoln.
Interesting. And what's your favorite period of Jewish history?
The one I'm in.
And what's the least appreciated era of Jewish history?
I think to a great extent, the modern Jewish world has a wrong picture of the 19th century in Jewish history, which was a pivotal century. That's one of the reasons I wrote my latest book, which deals with that. It's because of the fact that the Holocaust cut off all personal relationship to that time. Those people aren't here to tell their story. And therefore we make up a story to fit our ideas, but it's not necessarily accurate.
Wow. And the last quick question is, what's your favorite sefer in Tanakh?
Trei Osar, I wrote a book on Trei Osar. I think the Nevi'im are, you're looking for inspiration in life, and you're looking for history, and you're looking for faith. You cannot do so without knowledge of Nevi'im, and I think Trei Osar is a very good example of Nevi'im.
Oh. And the last question is a question that every episode ends with, which is, Rabbi Wein, you've been a rav of multiple communities, and you've been a guest speaker so many places, you've been on so many panels, and you've even done other interviews for publications and podcasts. But even though you've been asked so many questions throughout your life, there's always questions people have never been asked that they wish they were. So I'm curious, reflecting back on all your successful years in many different places, what's a question you've never been asked that you wished you were, and what answer would you give to it?
I'm pretty much a private person, so I have no longing to have people ask me questions. Oh. I really find that difficult to answer.
Does an interview ever leave and you wish that they would have asked you something different or something further?
I go with the flow. I try not to regret what I said. I never regret what I never said. So I'd like to leave it at that.
Okay. Well, thank you again for joining.
My pleasure, and you be matzliach.
Thank you for listening to this past episode of the Jewish Schmooze podcast. To get our latest updates and contact us, you can follow us on Twitter at Jews_Schmooze. If you want to sponsor an upcoming episode, you can reach out to JewsSchmoozeMarketing@gmail.com. And if you give us a 5-star rating on whatever platform you're listening on, that would be tremendously appreciated. Thank you so much, and hope you're looking forward to the next episode also.